Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 131 of Wheat All About It, or what I'm calling, If Glyphosate's Glory Days Are Gone, What Comes Next? The first part of a two-part conversation with Washington State University weed scientists Ian Burke and Drew Lyon. In this episode, the three of us discuss what is better known as Roundup, but actually comes in many generic formulations under different names. The key ingredient is glyphosate, which has come under multiple clouds recently, sending the stock value of Bayer, which purchased Monsanto last year for $63 billion, plummeting. I traveled to Cooper Publication Building on the WSU campus on May 8, 2019, to face Burke and Lyon across a round table with a microphone in the center. See a photo of the setup on the Washington Grain Commission Facebook page. There's a lot of elements to the ongoing glyphosate debate. In the podcast, Burke and I talk about the most recent addition, a study released by Michael Skinner, a professor of biochemistry at WSU, that found an intergenerational effect of glyphosate. That is, according to his research, it's not the person who applies the glyphosate that sees the health impact, but his or her descendants two or three generations later. Skinner's research was done using rats with high levels of glyphosate injected directly into the gut. But glyphosate has had a target painted on its back since 2015, when the cancer arm of the World Health Organization announced that glyphosate was probably carcinogenic. For the record, the EPA said glyphosate wasn't carcinogenic in 2013, and they reiterated that declaration just a couple of months ago. But as you'll hear ahead, in a world where emotion rules the debate, it doesn't matter that glyphosate is regarded by scientists as one of our safer chemicals. Based on my interview with Burke and Lyon, I think I can say without fear of being contradicted that there are a whole bunch of people responsible for helping wound the goose that laid the glyphosate egg. Farmers are only the last link in the chain. But some farmers have taken advantage, pushing the envelope for when it's acceptable to spray the chemical. Using glyphosate as a method of burning down a wheat crop to prepare it for harvest isn't done in eastern Washington. But in wetter areas of the U.S., it is, and the public relations fallout over the practice hasn't been pretty. Things may look bleak, but my scientific panel of two was not writing glyphosate's obituary. The goose is wounded, not dead. There's life left in the old girl, but as Lyon observes ahead, the chemical is on the slide downward. The only question is how steep the incline. Burke, who has the carefully calibrated voice of a scientist used to weighing various parameters, leads off the conversation. Lyon's extension appointment is reflected in his voice when he provides applied implications for Burke's theoretical underpinnings. He comes in about 5 minutes after Burke. I started by asking Burke to describe glyphosate and how we have gotten to this point in history, 45 years after it was released.
Glyphosate is the most used herbicide in the United States currently. It's also a relatively persistent molecule in the environment, and it's persistent in plant tissue. So when I think about glyphosate and a lot of the residue testing that's occurring, both by government agencies and by private companies, not NGOs, I get concerned for our ability to use it. I get concerned about the use profiles we put it into. We're using it, for instance, as a pre-harvest burndown treatment. I don't know that that's the best place for it. I know that regardless of the litigation, regardless of the jury decisions, whatever the science says about whether it's cancerous or not, cancer-causing agent or not, it appears to me the public has decided that they're not really interested in eating glyphosate or consuming glyphosate in any way. And so we need to figure out a way to use it so that it's not in our food stream, to respect that choice that the public has made. I, you know, in my opinion, that ship has sailed.
What about this new research that Michael Skinner, a professor at WSU, came up with that said that it's not the glyphosate that you apply today that's going to harm you, but it's the glyphosate that you apply today that's going to affect your progeny generations hence?
I'm not a toxicologist, and although I reviewed Dr. Skinner's work, it's difficult for me to render an opinion on it. I do know that he's observed similar outcomes with other chemicals. And it always seems to be a lack of effects in the generation of application, but clear effects later on. And so I think that there's more science to do there before I fully accept some of his, what I would consider, initial findings on intergenerational effects of glyphosate.
Well, and he's injecting this glyphosate into rats' guts.
There's a recent news report in the popular press. They discovered glyphosate in some popular beers and wines at relatively low concentrations. That speaks to the nature of the use. We use a lot of glyphosate. It's likely around us in a way that the plants can absorb and concentrate it in whatever fruiting bodies they produce. And then there it is in our food stream. We can go find it in products like that. So it's likely getting in your gut in some way, shape, or form. The EPA has a pretty rigorous registration process. They take into account human consumption, the likelihood of you consuming it, and they call that the hazard. And then they also carefully evaluate the pesticides that we use for their toxicity. And you put those together, the EPA sets very firm limits, but it's not faultless, this process. And there's clearly a lot of space for more research to for fully understand it. And we should do that because it is the most used pesticide. It is in the environment.
Well, when you say the public has made this decision, what do you mean by that? Does that mean that, we're going to eventually phase out glyphosate use?
I think that glyphosate use will likely revert to what it initially was. We were using it as an aid to tillage, if not an outright tillage replacement. We were applying it in such a way that there were no detectable levels found in any of the products that came off the fields. And in that use profile, I think I would review that as a very acceptable risk associated with the use of a pesticide. Over the years, we've seen a real expansion of glyphosate use because we have a broad acreage of transgenic crops that are resistant to it. We've seen a proliferation of homeowner products. And then we've expanded the labels in such a way that you can now use it pre-harvest. And that last piece is, I think, what will change. We just won't be able to apply it to our crops.
What about landscape and homeowner use? Should we just restrict it to agricultural use?
Potentially. That's not necessarily for me to judge, though. I know that the ag producers I work with are pretty good about following the label directions. I don't know that I necessarily have a sense of what the homeowners are doing with it, but I'm not sure they're necessarily following the label like they should be. And I don't want to throw homeowners under the bus, but homeowners' use of pesticides has over the years been indicted in a lot of different ways for misuse. They tend to overapply.
Recently, I was asked by our pesticide registration, or not registration person, but our pesticide overseer, what herbicides, how much glyphosate we used on our farms around Pullman, and what that cost, and if we weren't going to use Roundup going forward, what would we use and what would that cost? And that tells me that the lawyers are starting to look at the potential liability now that we've had these successful lawsuits, and we might see state agencies and the like being told you will not use Roundup because of fear for litigation. So as Ian was saying, to me, the science still suggests that glyphosate's one of the safer products out there. And yet that doesn't really matter because now we've got these lawsuits that have brought in millions of dollars. Litigation's going to go wild, and that's going to force people's hands on how they use this product going forward. So whether the science is supportive of it or not, I think glyphosate is probably has seen its glory days. And even from a standpoint of herbicide resistance, it's probably seen its glory days. We're starting to develop resistance to glyphosate. So its days are, it's on the slide down. How steep that slide's going to be, we'll have to keep watching to see. But between lawyers and consumers, and just its efficacy going forward. I think we're going to see less glyphosate use.
It's so disappointing because, you know, we're constantly told follow the science, and yet you're saying that, hey, we got to follow the perception.
What we've learned in some of the scientific societies I belong to is people don't make up their minds based on facts. They make it up on emotion, and then they look for the facts to support it. So the emotion is people don't like big multinational companies, and they don't like pesticides because they're considered unsafe. You know, the the strongest correlations for cancer are with alcohol consumption, obesity, smoking, and too much red meat. And people do all that all the time. And there's very little correlation with pesticides. And yet they fear pesticides. It's an emotional response. It's not based on fact or scientific evidence. And that's the world we live in.
So here we are in the Northwest. I mean, we didn't start using glyphosate as much as the Midwest, but we're using it a whole lot now. What would happen if suddenly tomorrow the government said, hey, no more glyphosate?
I think we'd probably do a little bit more tillage. And that's an unfortunate side effect of the cost and convenience of glyphosate. The input is really, really inexpensive. And it's a very effective tool. And you take that out of the toolbox, and you know, my perception is that a grower would go find the next economically viable, most economically viable tool that fit within their system and their constraints. And that could be tillage, and it could be some other cocktail of herbicides.
Well, and one of the herbicides that farmers could use is paraquat, you know, and paraquat comes with a skull and crossbones. And it just seems ironic that you can use an older chemical like paraquat, which has multiple health effects, and here is glyphosate that is tarred and feathered. You know, explain that to me.
I'll try and do so. So clearly this is a complicated set of situations we're trying to address here. So I'll try and do as best I can. So paraquat is what we call an acute toxin, and it's the most toxic herbicide we use. It's an electron receptor, and it accepts electrons in your neurons just as easily as it accepts electrons from the photosystem in plants. And so you really can't consume any amount of this material. But it has a really interesting fate profile in the environment. And so when you introduce it to a plant, it burns the tissue it comes in contact with and goes no further, doesn't translocate. When it touches soil, it almost immediately binds to the soil permanently. So as a consequence, the greatest hazard is to the applicator. And it really represents little, if any, hazard to anyone who would consume a product of the field it was applied to. In fact, there's no hazard. Glyphosate is a little different. As I mentioned before, you apply glyphosate in the same sort of use profile, say, just before harvest to desiccate the crop. Well, if the timing is a little off and there's still just a little bit of green plant, and that plant is actively translocating material still to the seed, you can, on occasion, detect glyphosate in the seed as a consequence. And paraquat doesn't do that. Although the hazard is deemed appropriate with glyphosate because it's non-toxic based on the EPA registration package, and that was just reaffirmed by the EPA this week, it doesn't represent a hazard in that use. Even though paraquat's the most toxic herbicide because of how it behaves in the environment, it doesn't represent a hazard to anyone except for the person using it.
Well, and that's the other thing you have to realize. You take glyphosate off the market and things will fill in for it. They tend to be more expensive, and they have a series of pros and cons as well. And so you don't just – but if you eliminate glyphosate, which is a very useful tool when used appropriately, you're going to substitute other things. It's not like now we're – have no more hazard out there. You have the paraquat, you have a lot of things. And because the expense is higher, as Ian was saying, no-till really didn't take off until glyphosate became cheap. When it became generic in 2000, we saw no-till really take off because now we had a cheap, effective herbicide that could replace tillage economically. You lose that, and you're going to see more tillage, and all the benefits we've gained from soil quality and soil health, maybe not all of them, but we're going to start going backwards again in soil health and soil quality. So which one do you want? You know, what's your preference?
Okay, well, let's address another elephant in the room, and that's, of course, weed resistance. Now, we know that resistance is happening to all sorts of chemical groups. What is glyphosate's chemical group, and what have we seen with regard to resistance of glyphosate in the Pacific Northwest? I'm going to add a second part to this question. Are farmers who apply glyphosate below labeled rates increasing the pace of resistance, and why?
Glyphosate resistance is increasing in the state. We've just documented downy brome resistant to glyphosate here in the last year. Before that, Russian thistle was found to be resistant to glyphosate. I'm suspicious we don't have kochia resistant to glyphosate based on some collections I've made. Italian ryegrass is also resistant in the state, although that's not really in the grain-producing areas yet. So we know that we're not immune. It can happen here. And it's actually not reduced rates that's causing the issue. It's an advancing increase of rates. And so the mentality goes along something like, well, it didn't work as well this year. Maybe I'll bump the rate a little bit and it'll work a little bit better. And we've now done that for two decades. I've heard rates well in excess of what perhaps should be being applied. Occurring, it's not off-label, but well over a quart. The maximum label rate for perennial crops is on the order of a half a gallon, and I know that we're likely applying that rate and not achieving control. And so, when that happens, the response really shouldn't be to apply more; it should be to figure out how to do something a little bit different because clearly something's not working. And so that rate advancement is really a symptom of overuse. And over-reliance.
Can you tank mix glyphosate?
Oh, yeah. It mixes pretty easily. In fact, it's quite compatible with many of our herbicides. It doesn't necessarily make sense to mix what we call a contact herbicide with glyphosate, which is systemic, because the contact type herbicide, like paraquat, for example, tends to destroy the linkages that the glyphosate would use to translocate. But it's quite compatible with many of our other products. And I know that for many years, 2,4-D was a popular mixture with glyphosate and still continues to be in many areas.
Yeah, I know in the 1990s, when I was in Western Nebraska, just starting my career, Roundup, there wasn't generic glyphosate at the time, Roundup was costing close to $90, $100 a gallon. Growers didn't want to use the 16 ounces that were recommended, so they wanted to cut that rate. And if they had any broadleaves, 16 ounces doesn't control very many broadleaf. Glyphosate's a great grass product, marginal broadleaf. The only way you get broadleaves is by upping the rate. So prior to generic glyphosate, 2,4-D dicamba was always added to glyphosate if you had a broadleaf. Once glyphosate got cheap, people started to drop that out, and that's one of the reasons we're seeing some of these problems. But it does tank mix well. It probably should have always been tank mixed, especially in fallow situations. And we're now seeing people going back to it because we have glyphosate-resistant Russian thistle and glyphosate.
But the cow is out of the barn.
It is. They should have been doing it all along. Yep.
When I think about glyphosate resistance evolution in the PNW, it's taken longer than other areas. And I think there's some contributing factors involved. We don't get a lot of rainfall, so the weeds don't make a lot of seed. They make seed, but not nearly as much as they might make in Georgia, for example. And so it's a numbers game. Nature's testing our selection pressure, and that she just doesn't have the numbers to overcome the selection as quickly as other areas. The other thing that's happened is we've seen an increase in chemical fallow, and that's take tillage out of the system. You need to replace it with something. Drew makes a really good point. Whenever he talks about integrated weed management, he talks about when you take something out of the toolbox, probably a good idea to put something back in there that would help whatever is left. So that appears to have happened in the fallow areas, particularly with downy brome. I think we just took too many tools out of the toolbox. We're only using glyphosate. And in that sort of situation, it's only a matter of time before selection acts in such a way that we lose the tool.
When I was a reporter in the 1990s, Monsanto was telling me that glyphosate resistance couldn't happen because of its unique mode of action. Is its mode of action unique? And, you know, there are now more than 40 weeds around the world resistant to glyphosate, including, of course, as you indicated, Russian thistle in eastern Washington. It sounds like this is the tip of the iceberg. Will there be a point at which Roundup is basically worthless?
Yeah, I would say there's probably going to be a point where glyphosate is worthless, but I don't know that we're anywhere near that yet. Maybe in a few fields where we've found this downy brome resistance, those growers might view it as nearly worthless just because they don't have many other weeds. And so we're not, it's not quite worthless yet across a broad region. Yeah. So glyphosate does have a unique mode of action. It's the only herbicide that inhibits the pathway in the plant that it does, which is EPSPS synthase, at least the only herbicide available on the market. Interestingly, if you dig a little deeper, you'll find there was a sugar discovered to inhibit the same pathway here recently reported. But glyphosate's the only one that is available on the market that does what it does. You know, I've read the same reports about Monsanto initially claiming that there wouldn't be resistance, and they had good basis for that statement. They had attempted to breed for resistance for 2 decades and hadn't found a crop that they could mutate in any way to make it resistant. And so they ultimately, you know, resorted to making them transgenic resistant. And so that was their basis. They made that statement, I think, in ignorance of what weeds could do and how they could evolve. And we've learned now just how amazing they are as species and their ability to evolve to this input.
Okay, so the chemical came to the market in 1974, glyphosate did, and it lost its patent in 2000, which made it cheaper. The earliest citation I could find for glyphosate resistance is to rigid ryegrass in Australia in 1996. Why did the problem first show up in Australia?
Australia, a lot of where the wheat zone is, wheat production zone in Australia, used to be what's called the wheat sheep zone. So they used to grow crop for a while, and then they turn it to pasture and they graze sheep. And they planted all that grazing land to rigid ryegrass. So then when the sheep market plummeted, I don't know when that was, in the 90s sometime, those people went to straight cropping, but they had just seeded millions of hectares or millions of acres with rigid ryegrass that now they needed to control. And Roundup glyphosate was used. I was over there in 1997 on a tour, and they already had cheap glyphosate. They were getting it out of China. So I think it was stolen stuff that they got cheap, and so they sprayed it on these millions of acres. And as we've mentioned, resistance is kind of a numbers game. You know, you spray enough plants, you're going to find those plants that have the mutation. And they had millions of acres planted to this very genetically diverse plant, rigid ryegrass, and they sprayed it with lots of Roundup. And of course, it didn't take them too many years before they were basically selected for those biotypes of rigid ryegrass that were resistant to glyphosate. I think that's why it showed up there first, because of the system they were in, and then changing the system and then relying so heavily on glyphosate, because at the time this was happening, they could get their hands on cheap glyphosate.
Fascinating. Fascinating. I've never heard that before. Thank you, Drew. So is Australia ahead of the U.S. in terms of dealing with weed resistance?
In certain regards, out of necessity, right? So necessity is the mother of invention, is the saying. And they have not had a way of dealing with this rigid ryegrass, and so they've gotten creative. And I think we're looking at some of the things they're doing and trying to figure out how we can adapt them to here. So in some ways they are. In other ways, maybe not so much. We have some very bright scientists here in the U.S. who have come up with some pretty clever things as well. But the Australians definitely, out of necessity, have gotten on the bandwagon a little earlier than some others.
It's amazing how we managed to stay one step ahead of disaster, but so far so good. That's the history of civilization. We may not be real good at charting our evolution, but we do seem to be able to come up with fixes when things go haywire. Episode 132 is a continuation of my conversation with Burke and Lyon, but we branch out into the wider topic of weed resistance, what it means for the future, and how farmers may be forced into practices they thought they'd left behind. Please join me here again next week for the episode I've entitled the wicked problem of herbicide weed resistance. Right here on Weed All About It!
Don't like chemicals, don't like killing. Look in your kitchen, the story there's killing. Plant food, Windex, mouse bait too. Mr. Clean, easy off, even pet shampoo. You wanna be a hypocrite? Just forget to have the shit. We feed you.